Hello and welcome to Holden Village. Today is August the 30th, 1999, and in Koinonia Creekside Room this morning is Ruth Doherty's session, What Separated the Eastern Orthodox from the Roman Church? Number 99-1. Let's listen in.
This was essentially the Roman world. You know, almost everything that we see here was under the Roman legis at that time. The Fertile Crescent, all of Africa, Spain, what we know now as France and Italy, up into Britain. They didn't really get up into Scandinavia, but most of this was Roman. And as you can guess, after a while, that's an awful lot of territory to deal with. And one of the problems with dealing with all of that is that they had to, at the same time, have enough armies in order to take care of it, because all the time there are people pushing in. This is a very fertile area. This is where people can live very well. These hinterlands are not as easy to live in, as you Norwegians know. It was very important to have a good army, and as they proceeded, they began to infiltrate these other people, what they call the barbarians, into the armies. But, gonna get a little better focusing on this? Just a try.
Well,
all
we can see is
the land. That was great. There. Is that better? Well, you have it also, you know this in Rome, that they tended to have several rulers, Caesars. And the Romans tended to be very superstitious. Their Caesar Augustus, ultimate one, was essentially honored as king, as God. And people were expecting that, the gods were expecting people to honor the king or the ruler, the Augustus. And of course, this is not the way the Christians wanted to deal, and so you had what we have known as the martyrdom, the persecutions. The persecutions were not as intense as some Christians would like to say they were. They were horrible under Decius. They were also horrible again under Diocletian. Diocletian came at the end of the third century. But in that time, by this time, the Christian church has grown very well. There are not only the poor people that are in the Christian church, but also very rich, as we can see by this family that has their picture within a cross, and the whole cross would be here, and these wonderful jewels around it to say how important this is for them to state that the cross, that the value of the cross and the richness of it was part of the wonderful gift that they were giving, and they were giving of themselves in this cross. And we have certainly lots of remnants of people being buried in the catacombs. They were not hiding down in the catacombs, but they were burying in them. This was a traditional place for burying, rather than being put along the road as the Romans were being buried up on top. At the end of the third century, now we're talking centuries. When I say centuries, that means 200s, right? Third century means 200, just like this is the 20th century, but it's the 1900s. So at the end of the third century, at the end of the 200s, Diocletian becomes the Caesar. And he wants to get in control of all this land. The place is continually weakening, so he wants to put down the Christians that are going to cause the problems for him. He thinks the Christians are causing the problems. So he begins a series of martyrdom, and at the same time, he builds himself a palace. You know where that is? Have you been there? In Split, Yugoslavia, Croatia. He was from Croatia, so he builds himself a palace. And you can still go there if you're courageous enough to go to Croatia.
That's a 3rd century building?
Yes.
Wow.
See, this is very Roman. Very Roman. So, of course, this is by now, it's just in ruins. But you have this burial chapel over here, and it's quite extensive. I've actually slept inside of this palace, which is, you know, maybe if the only problem with sleeping there is it gets noisy. Mm-hmm. But he did not last long, and it was in the beginning of the 4th century that you have Constantine coming in as one of the Caesars, fighting with the other Caesars, seeing this vision of the cross at the Bridge of Miletus, and defeating the other Caesars, becoming the supreme Caesar, the Caesar Augustus, and declaring for Christianity. This is nothing new for you, I'm sure. Constantine. So, one of the things that Constantine does, and most significant for our story, is that he is going to build himself a city. And he builds himself a city in what we call Turkey now, in Constantinople. I should have this. What happened in there? Yes. See, this is where Istanbul is. Recently called Istanbul, not Constantinople. You can see these are part of the lands that we're hearing about in Acts. So they're very close to the Bible lands. And one of the reasons I think that it became such an important city was because this connection. You have, and I'm going back, he built himself an absolutely fantastic city here. It is still a fantastic city, though now by there are about 11 million people living here and crossing over into this whole area. You have the same building of the Roman Forum, the Hippodrome, you have aqueducts, and you have marvelous places for holding water that he all included in there. And in the process, he brings the capital from Rome to Constantinople. That leaves Rome as not a capital. The Rome then is just sort of the old place where all the roads still lead to. And it still remains a very important place. Therefore, when you start dealing with who is important in the church, because Constantine makes the Christian church then the Church of Rome, and he has the Council of Nicaea, which is ends up being about in here, Nicaea is about there, decide some of the issues about the church. And some of the issues say, who's God? Who is Jesus? Constantine said, you know, if we're going to have a church, they all have to agree. We have to agree. And so we're going to get together and decide what we're supposed to believe. Well, you know, when you start doing that, you have ins and outs, right? And what happens, what do we get as a result of this particular council in 325? The Nicene Creed. Which says, what does it say about Jesus? God of God, light of light, true God of very God, begotten, not made, of one being with the Father, through him whom all things were made. So what is the whole idea of that is to say Jesus is God and man. Well, the big problem here is that the Arians are at the same time saying, well, Jesus is a man. He may have been the highest of men, created men. God? We don't think so. And so immediately you have ins and outs. So those who accept the Nicene Creed are on the ins, and those who accept the other are on the outs. Well, Rome had done a wonderful job of building, I hate to bring this in, just I'm bragging. See, there I am with my bicycle. And this is on the in the aqueduct here. Nah, why can't I think? It's just north of Arles. But it is a huge thing. If you realize how big, what a strong country Rome had been to build all these wonderful aqueducts that are still standing, unless people have taken them down in order to build other buildings with. Which has also been true of a lot of the Colosseums and the amphitheaters. They've become quarries. Anyway, this strong country is being invaded by all these people. A lot of them are the Norse who have actually come down later on are coming down all the way to Constantinople. But you have the Vandals, I'm going to follow this line, the Vandals are coming from the east, being pushed by the Huns, and they come all the way down through Spain into Africa, and then in 410 come up and, what do they do to Rome? Let's use the word, vandalize. They vandalize Rome. They're the first one of these people to come in and just take over Rome.
Are they vandalizing right the way along?
Probably. Probably everywhere they go. In fact, this is probably true of all of these different groups must thank you. I appreciate that. All of these different groups are eating and taking as they go. Now, this is the way the armies moved at this time. And when you have, later on when we have the Crusades talking, going up down to the east, Near East, they're eating everything along the way. They're just like locusts. You have, I'm guessing these are the black line, the Visigoths, they're showing up here. The Visigoths come down into Spain, and they actually come into Rome. They vandalized Rome in 456, and then they actually settle in Spain. The Ostrogoths come down and they settle in Ravenna and establish a wonderful, wonderful civilization of their own in Ravenna. This is what is left of Visigoth church in Toledo, Spain. Obviously, the Muslims have put in a doorway, but it is the closest I could come to actually seeing some of the buildings that the Visigoths had done. And this would have been about 700. And Rincesvith, now that's the name. I often wonder about the Sphinx, whether how Norse that was when we think of Sphinx coming from the Scandinavians. But this was his crown, the Visigoth crown. Had a very strong settlement there until the Muslims came. That's in Spain. This is something that's built in Ravenna, and you can still see it there. This is an Arian baptistry built by Theodoric. Now, an Arian baptistry says, I believe Jesus was baptized, but I don't believe he was God. But if you go into this baptistry and look at the paintings, I have so many slides I did not bring. Look at the mosaics in the ceiling, and then you go over to the Christian baptistry that was built about a little bit later. the mosaics are almost exactly the same. You cannot tell the difference between their appreciation of Jesus in this one as opposed to the regular accepted Christian baptistry. Theodoric was a very strong man. He was very interested in the Romans. He wanted to be a Roman ruler. He wanted to reestablish the West. And so this seems like it's not focused. He established this was something that he had built for himself. This is one piece of stone. That takes organization in order to have his people move that. There may be a slide that's not going down. Yeah. Sorry. Something I'm going to look at now. Well, we've been talking pretty much about what's going on in the West. Meanwhile, in the East, with all of the Vandals and all of the Ostrogoths coming in, and Huns and Goths, Franks, the Eastern Empire has lost a lot of people, lost a lot of land. And so Justinian, this is a mosaic of Justinian in the church in Ravenna, decides he's going to capture it. So he has a very wonderful general, Belisarius, and he goes into the West, recaptures a lot of the lands, both in Africa and in Spain and in Italy, that the others had taken over. He's spending a lot of money and a lot of time doing this. At the same time, he's fighting off the Persians. And at the same time, he's in love with an actress, falls in love with Theodora, and this is her portrait opposite his in the church, which is the Church of San Vitale in Ravenna, which he had built. One of the, it's amazing, this church is one of those, it looks like it's round, but it's not. It's octagonal. What it is a circle in a square, which is dealing both with the terrestrial in the square and the heavenly in the circle. And so this was one of the great ways that the rulers in the world were building their churches, in this octagonal shape. And it is an absolute, I had the other projector, which was refocusing this down, and this one's not doing as well. This is an absolutely beautiful church. Absolutely. The mosaics are extraordinary. And of course, the mosaics are so typical of the Eastern Orthodox Church. Now, he did not bring, there's not a lot of difference in the religion at this point yet between the Roman and the Eastern churches. But there are some differences that have come up. For one thing, in 405, Jerome has translated the Bible into what language?
Latin.
Into Latin. In the eastern part of the country, in the eastern part of the Roman, they were using Greek. And so already you have this kind of difference. You have a cultural difference. If you looked at the difference between Diocletian's palace and this, though there are a few hundred years in between, Diocletian is not using any mosaics. They're using a tremendous amount of mosaics. And you have a difference in terms of how rulers are taking over. This is a church that Theodoric had built, an Arian church. When Justinian takes over, he removes some of the mosaics from here and replaces them with his own mosaics for his own people. And it's sort of like that with a little bit with the way you dispose of rulers in the Eastern church in the eastern part of the empire, if you didn't like, if you wanted to be ruler, you would find poison, or you would find a way of poisoning somebody's children, or even your own children, if you wanted to make sure that somebody else was going to be ruler. My goodness, I'm going to get that other projector. I couldn't reverse with it. Justinian also built this absolutely fantastic church. Have you seen this? Mm-hmm. Any of you seen Hagia Sophia?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. I wish I had my own slides of that I had taken on the interior because they're so much better. This is in Istanbul and Constantinople. It, at the time, this was built in the middle of the 500s, middle of the 6th century. I've read books on Muslim architecture, and they say, oh, we didn't imitate our mosques after the Hagia Sophia. Oh, I can't believe it. You know, it is so unique, and this was done so much sooner. Their mosques, they don't start building their mosques like this until after they have captured this territory. But it is so fantastic. Of course, you have now the Muslim things that for their that have been intruded in this. It's now a museum. And the top collapsed, and they had to rebuild it and support it on the side. But none of the other mosques in Istanbul are as high as this one. And this was built about 1,000 years sooner.
For engineering reasons?
Well, maybe for engineering reasons, perhaps.
Or is it because this was considered a representative of some superior?
I don't know. I never asked them why they didn't build it as high. But it could be for engineering reasons, because they had to use a lot of supports on the outside of this building in order to hold it up. In fact, if you look at this, you can see these strong, strong buttresses.
Yeah, I think it was interesting that the Muslims had covered over, plastered with those, some of the mosaics, which are now
We've been uncovering them. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
But you see, we'll be dealing with that. Those mosaics are not until after the 1300s. We do not have the old mosaics in Hagia Sophia because the iconoclastic.
It may not be mosaics.
Oh yes, there are mosaics there.
Okay.
Oh yeah, but the old mosaics were actually destroyed by the Byzantines themselves.
Okay.
Well, actually, in the process of building all these things, of conquering the territory, Justinian becomes weakened, and so his army, he essentially breaks down. But I wanted to go back to this. The Hagia Sophia is it's Greek for what?
Holy wisdom.
Holy wisdom. What what tense is that? Masculine or feminine?
Feminine.
What is it in the Latin church? Spiritus Sanctus. What gender is that? Okay, when William the Conqueror conquered Britain, he promised to build 3 churches. One, it was actually where he landed. 2 in Cannes. One was for men and one for women. This is the Church of the Trinity, which was built for his wife, for Matilda. This is the Trinity. Now, you would never see this kind of an image of the Trinity in the Eastern Orthodox Church, because it would be much more of a unity. Here it's actually shown as 3 different persons. It's one of those terribly difficult concepts anyway. When, in the year before I was confirmed, you know, we had all these kids standing up in church, and they were supposed to answer questions, and our pastor posed to one of the girls the easiest question he thought he could give her. He said, how many gods are there? And she said, 3. Because it's such a difficult situation to deal with. This is one of the subjects that the Eastern Church has been very strong on. Athanasius was there and dealing with it intensively. So they would never have had that kind of an image. Another thing that we would have to deal with in terms of what was going on in the church and the Trinity is that in Spain in the 600s, they, in order to fight Visigoths, in order to fight the Arian heresy, they had decided to add the Filioque to the Nicene Creed. Now the Filioque says, and I believe in the Holy Ghost, who proceeds from the Father, and this is the Filioque, and the Son. That had never been in the original Nicene Creed. And the Eastern Orthodox Church said, whoa, you're saying something about the Holy Spirit. You're saying that the Holy Spirit is third man down or second man down, and that Jesus and God, Jesus and the Father are equal, but the Spirit is less than. Well, the Western Church said, now wait a minute, that's not the way we saw it. We just needed to clarify that Jesus was really God and not just a man. And so we say that the Holy Spirit proceeded from him too. Well, that has never been settled. They objected to it because the Eastern Church said anything that has done has to be done via council. And it was never done in a council, therefore they have not accepted it. And there have been times that they have tried to come back and have a rapprochement on that, and it's never succeeded. So that was one of the big things. Another big difference is their tremendous focus. I really should have spent time playing with that picture.
Well, I think the screen isn't flat either.
Well, the screen's not flat, and it's not as long as I'd like it to be. We might move into the other room. Is their focus on the Theotokos, on the Mother of God? There was a Marian cult in the Eastern Church very, very early on. And they were talking about the Theotokos in the liturgy, the bearer of God, the God-bearer, or the Mother of God, very, very early on. And in the Council of 431, there was an attempt to make this an official doctrine of the church, that Mary was the God-bearer. And Nestor, who was actually Patriarch of Constantinople at that time, said, now wait a minute. If she's the God-bearer, that can't be true, because God has always been there. She's just not the one who is the Mother of God. God has always existed from the beginning. She is only the bearer of Jesus. So she can't be the Theotokos, the God-bearer, or the Mother of God. Well, you know what happened to Nestor? He ended up being convicted of heresy, excommunicated, and he ended up actually ending up his Nestorian heresy spreading all the way to China. But he didn't make it, and the Theotokos became the official doctrine of the Eastern Church. And at this time, the Western Church is just sort of a, oh yeah, situation. Whatever comes from there, we're sort of accepting, but never with that same enthusiasm that the Eastern Church had. At the time that she was actually proclaimed Theotokos, of course, it could be that the people were a little bit oiled in Istanbul in order at this point. But they had great parades, torchlight parades, wonderful exclamations that Mary had been named Theotokos. This is actually a picture of a icon that is in Mount Sinai Monastery. It is one from the 600s. And the reason I said there weren't any from earlier in the Hagia Sophia is because of the iconoclastic controversy. I put in here pictures of St. John of Ephesus, the church, just to show the strength of the Eastern Church and the buildings that were going on at that time. Sometimes I wondered why I did this, but these were things, pictures I took when we were there. So many places when we are in Turkey, the crosses have been scratched out. And I went to a lot of mosques that had been Christian churches to see where the crosses had been scratched out. But here at St. John's in Ephesus, they're still there. This is another icon from Mount Sinai. They had, what was happening at this time, Justinian had weakened the empire. And so when you had the Muslim Mohammedan coming out with his Quran and his exclamation of Allah, he got all the Arabs together and they began to expand the territory. And I'll come back to that a little bit. It's a possibility that that is one reason why the leaders in the Eastern Church were saying, we've got to not have icons any longer. The icons were very important. It was something that was seemed to be an idol more than just something for worship. Actually, the Eastern Orthodox saying, this is a means of worship. When we're looking at an icon, that means that person, that Mary or Jesus or this saint is actually here with us. Very much present with us now, today. So the icons were very important. But because the Muslims said, we can't have any representations, it is possible that the kings, the rulers in the Byzantium, were also saying, therefore, let's get rid of the icons. One of the things that's happening is that you have a very big difference in who's ruling. In the Byzantine Empire, you have the ruler actually ruling the church. The ruler of the empire is also in charge of the church. In the Western Empire, you had, by this time, essentially no rulers any longer. You had no kings, no Caesars, and the most important person was, in the West?
The Pope.
The Pope. The most important person was the Pope. So you have a lot of different small rulers, no one big one, and it's the Pope that sort of gathers the Western part together. It's the rulers in the East that gather the East together. So you have sort of a flip here. And it's the Eastern rulers that say to the church, we're not going to have any icons any longer. And so they go around destroying all the icons. Now it's also a possibility that they were objecting to the fact that the monasteries were very strong at this time. And they wanted to get rid of the power of the monasteries, who were the ones who were creating the icons. In any case, there are very, very, very few icons left from that time. Only up in Mount Sinai, this monastery, way up in the desert, do you still see icons. And this is a reliquary from that time. In other words, this would be not only have a picture on it, but it would also have some element of a saint included inside of that reliquary. So not only would you have the picture, but you also had definitely that presence of some very important person that will be supposedly connected. And this is a cross in the form of a reliquary, also from that time. But there are so few things left. All of that religious those religious icons from those early centuries have been destroyed. And it's not the mosaics that you see in the Hagia Sophia now are only those that come after the icon controversy is over, and that ends about 853. Well, this is the development, the expansion of Islam, and they come from here, come up and take over this, then they begin to expand even further. Take care, there's only a little bit left of the Byzantine Empire. We realize all of this had been Roman Empire, all of this had been the Byzantine Empire. Now, all this green is Muslim, going up here to Spain. You have Charlemagne beginning to be important up here, and these are a variety of people who convert this area. So, when you have this happening, Istanbul becomes much more vulnerable. It's not quite right here. And they become just sort of impacted. When ultimately the Seljuk Turks, these were not too bad, Eastern Orthodox Church could sort of survive these people. They kind of gave up on this. But when the Seljuk Turks came in here, they really threatened this, moved in a little bit further. And so this is the time when the ruler in Istanbul says, "Help!" But something very important had happened before that. In about the middle of the 11th century, about 1050, the Pope in Rome had sent over a legate, one of his representatives, to the Byzantine Empire and said, "Hey, is there, can't we get together? We've got different law cultures, we've got different languages, we've got different ways of governing our country, but we still really believe in the same God." And they were trying to get together. Periodically, there had been attempts to get the two churches together. You had just a tremendous power base here and a tremendous power base here as far as the church is concerned. Here, they had Christianized up into Russia. Here they had Christianized up into England. So they had both gone out in different ways in order to expand Christianity. They said, "Well, why can't we get together?" So the Pope in Rome sent a legate to Constantinople. And things are going pretty well. But they said, "Now don't take any silk or anything." They're very worried about what's been going on. This is very rich. They're very rich here because they've been trading with the East, with China, with India. They're very rich people. He said, "Well, don't take any of the silk with you." At least this is what the legend goes. But unfortunately, somehow this legate took some with him. And on the way out, sort of at the border, he gets caught. And there is a the patriarch here in the Eastern Orthodox Church says, "This is the kind of pope you have. This is the kind of church you have. We tell you not to do this, and you do that." And it's not the first time that they've been excommunicating each other. They had, the pope in Rome had excommunicated the patriarch in Constantinople because of the iconoclasm. And now they're doing it again. Okay, one guy excommunicates one Muslim. "You're going to excommunicate me? Okay, I'll excommunicate you." And so it goes back and forth. Essentially, there is a schism in 1054 that is irreparable. And it's over minor things. But there have been so many other little things. Mary. Language.
the Trinity. And there's a big difference in the way people think. The Eastern Church is very mystic, very right-brained. The Western Church is very left-brained. It seems so definite. And the Eastern Church is so involved with creating a place where people, when they come to worship, is just like heaven. I walked into the narthex of a Russian church, and I was with a guy who was a Russian Orthodox, and I said, oh, I walked in there, it was so beautiful, it was just like being in heaven. She said, that's what they want it to be. Exactly. So that you walk into these churches and you're in a place where God is, definitely a place where God is, and your worship, your liturgy, is an experience of God. It's not to rev you up, it's to experience, to meditate, to feel that celestial presence. And this was very different from the way that was going on in the Western Church. So you had a lot of differences. then we got a really big one coming up. They already had decided that it's done. And then comes the Comenius plea for help. Please come over and help us. What he wanted is someone to come over and push back the Seljuk Turks. So they had a little breathing space there around Constantinople. But when Pope Urban II in Vesely calls for the crusade, he gets a lot of enthusiastic response. There are people, they are saying, you know, he says, go over and say sort of what Mia said last night, you know, give your life for a great cause. And these people are jumping to do it. And there are a variety of other reasons why they do it, but which we'll talk about when we actually talk about the Crusades. But so they come here and they go off, all set to go on Crusades. But what happens, boom, the Comnenus was expecting knights. And there were some knights that jumped to take the cross because they thought they would like to get some of that land over there. It's getting a little crowded in France. But what really happened is, first of all, is that there were a mob of just people who had not had good life. And they said, let's go. I don't care. I'm going to give my life for my, go off and be a martyr and reclaim Jerusalem. Now, Comnenus, the ruler in Constantinople, didn't care about reclaiming Jerusalem. They had been getting along pretty well with the Muslims. Muslims said, you know, you can live here, just pay taxes. I'm not going to keep you from going into Jerusalem. I'm not going to keep any pilgrims from coming here. There's so many things I have to tell you, but my brain keeps telling me about all this other stuff I'm not telling you. Pilgrims were eager to get to Jerusalem, you see. And so the West said, let's clean up Jerusalem. Let's get Jerusalem back from the Muslim, from these heathens. Well, so all these people come rushing. What was I saying about what the Vandals and so forth did as they came across the territory? They vandalized. They just ate. They took. They also attacked the Jews, but we'll have to talk more about that another time. But when they got to Constantinople, Comnenus says, what am I going to do with these people? And he feeds them and sends them across, and many of them are killed in very short order. But meanwhile, they have just ravaged Hungary. They have just drained the Byzantine Empire in order for food. When the knights do come, I'm a little ahead of myself. When the knights do come, and they take their time because they gather their armies and there's so much together to do it, deal with that. They come to Comnenus and he says, now, he makes them a sign practically in blood. Now, whatever lands you take, you give back to capture Antioch and Edessa and Acre and Jerusalem. They say, we captured it, now it's ours. Well, that was one aspect. So they have despoiled a lot of Byzantine lands in the process of getting there, and then they claimed the land for themselves. That was the first crusade. Well, it didn't change any differently in the second and the third, but the fourth was the ultimate. The fourth was when the Venice, who was very much in power and wanting to get what the Byzantine had, convinced the pilgrims to go with them and first capture Constantinople. So they did not go to Jerusalem. They captured Constantinople, broke down the walls, and pillaged. They just took everything they could get. They just grabbed whatever they had and took the relics out of Hagia Sophia. They stole everything that they could get their hands on, and then established that part of the Byzantine Empire as a Roman enclave. So they established a Roman Christian church in what was in Constantinople and that area around. The Byzantine Empire was then pushed way over. I don't know if you've been to Trabzon. It's very close to Russia on the Black Sea. There was a small enclave where the Byzantine Empire remained in another small part around Nicaea, where they continued to be, and eventually, after 60 years, pushed the Romans back out of that space. But once they had done that, it is practically impossible for anyone to say, these were the people that were sent by the church. They were not sent by another ruler. They were sent by one church over to another, and then they steal and rob and pillage the church. So if we could have, and if there's ever a chance of getting together, it would be pretty hard. You probably got things to say or questions to ask.
When they invaded Constantinople, did they kill the patriarch at the time?
No, but they killed a lot of people, destroyed the walls, burned the city.
So they prevented the patriarch from ruling in Constantinople?
Yeah, I think he was able to get out. That's why they moved then the ruling seat to Trabzon. Trabzon actually built another Hagia Sophia church, Hagia Sophia, there in that area. A minuscule one.
What was the year of the first pope?
The first pope?
Mm-hmm.
Well, you have, what happens is that you have a lot of, the popes are just bishops.
Mm-hmm.
And so you had a bishop at Jerusalem, Antioch, Ephesus, Alexandria, and Rome, because Rome was the place where the St. Paul had gone. They, you know, the talk about it being based on the apostles, that's not until much later.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't discover, I think it was in 1953 actually, that they dug down and thought they found bones of St. Peter. But they were first century bones anyway, and claimed them to be St. Peter's. But it wasn't until much later that they used that Matthew gospel saying that Jesus says, I give you the keys of the kingdom.
Mm-hmm.
It was just simply because the apostles had come there, and so they had based it on the apostles. Rome became important because all roads lead to Rome.
Mm-hmm.
And so you had, this was the metropolis. This was the big city. Later on, that just dwindled. The people moved into the country, and Istanbul. And I keep, you know, because I was in Istanbul. Constantinople takes more time to say. became very big, huge, and all the Alexandria, Antioch, Jerusalem,
became unimportant bishops, bishoprics, compared to the patriarch then in Constantinople. So therefore you have the two church leaders. Okay. Thank you for asking that. It's a kind of thing.
Egypt still has their own patriarch.
You have a patriarch in Russia too. Mm-hmm. See, especially after
they call
church
the Pope, but you know, of Egypt.
Yeah, especially after the Zante Church broke down. Mm-hmm. Especially after 1453, when the Muslims captured and sort of ended that, there's still a patriarch there in Istanbul. I can say that correctly now. Mm-hmm. But there's also a patriarch in Russia. You have Serbian, mm-hmm. you have the Serbian Orthodox, and you have the Greek Orthodox, and you have the Russian Orthodox, and you have the Egyptian Orthodox. Mm-hmm. And then you also have the Coptic churches and the Armenian churches, which are offshoots. Any other comments or questions?
What was the time frame of the Crusades?
The first one started in 1095. And you could say the Crusades went on for a long time. Mm-hmm. The second one was in the middle of the 11th century. The fourth one was 1204. After that, there were other Crusades, but they were really minor. The third one was with Richard the Lionheart that we captured, Cochrane. Frederick II goes back and he just talks to the leader and gets Jerusalem back, you know, which is another story.
He died on the way, didn't he, in
Turkey? Louis the Ninth, St. Louis, died on the way. Mm-hmm. He became sick. So. It's the Crusades are a wonderful story. They're a wonderful story, and you wonder how Saint Bernard could ever have gotten involved with the Crusades. Mm-hmm. But he did, because it's just a different way of looking at things, just a different way of seeing. And I think I'm not sure if it's next tomorrow or the next day is that we're talking about what do people actually believe. Because that's so crucial. What were people actually believing in? Anyone else with a question or comment?
When did Moscow become the Third Rome, as it was called?
I can't tell you that. No, but they were Christianized in about the 1000s.
Yeah,
and that's one of those interesting things where the Norse come down from the south, and they may have established centers in Russia and then brought Christianity back up. Crazy, you know, how nothing is simple.